welcome.
Shalom and welcome to another issue of Torah Tidbits Audio brought to you by OU Israel. I'm your host Phil Chernofsky and this show is being broadcast for the first time on Ta'anit Esther, Ta'anit Esther Mukdam, Ta'anit Esther that is pulled earlier since Purim for the rest of the world is on Saturday night, Sunday. The day before Shabbat would not be appropriate for Ta'anit Esther, and the rabbis pulled it back to Thursday. I'll discuss a little bit more about that in a moment. It is Thursday, Shabbat Parshat Tetzaveh, also the second of the four special Shabbatot, Shabbat Zachor. We'll talk about that as well. It is also Thursday, March 1st. I don't know if we'll talk about that, except to say happy birthday to my brother Nachum, whose birthday in the secular calendar is the 2nd of March, or as our father liked to call it, the 2th of March. So we have a lot of things to talk about. Ta'anit Esther, Parshat Zachor, Parshat Tetzaveh, Purim for the rest of the world, Purim Yerushalayim. I don't think we'll get to too many of those things, but we'll try to touch upon some interesting topics. First, Psalm 130, Tehillim Kuf Lamed. Shir ha-ma'alot mi-ma'amakim karaticha Adonai. Adonai shima v'koli, tehiyena aznecha kashuvot l'kol tachanunai. Im avonot tishmor yoh Adonai mi ya'amod, ki yemecha haslicha l'ma'an tivarei. Kiviti Adonai kiveta nafshi v'lidvaro hocholti. Nafshi l'Adonai mi shomerim laboker, shomerim laboker. Yachel Yisrael el Adonai ki im Adonai hachesed v'harbe imo fedut. V'hu yifde et Yisrael mikol avonotav. Achenu kol beit Yisrael hanetunim batzara uvashivya, ha'omidim bein bayam uvein bayabasha, ha'makom yirachim aleihem v'yotzieim mitzara lirvacha, u'me'afela l'ora u'mishibud l'gu'ula, hashta ba'agala uvizman kariv v'nomar amen. That last prayer, Achenu kol beit Yisrael, is appropriate all the time, but it definitely reminds you of Purim, because of Megillat Esther specifically, because of the expression asking God to take us from darkness to light, from slavery to redemption, now and speedily in our time, v'nomar amen, that me'afela l'ora mitzara lirvacha, from difficult straits to comfort. That contrast between what was or is and what could be in the salvation is right out of the Megillah. So we are acutely aware of that at this time of year, and hopefully we will see other causes to celebrate Purim style when soon the hostages are released, when Jonathan Pollard is returned home, and things will look better and brighter for Jews all over the world, and for the world itself. Whether you are listening to this on Ta'anit Esther or later, it doesn't matter as far as the music is concerned, which I hope to put on shortly, because Ta'anit Esther is not a mournful day, it's just a serious day. But it's still close enough to the Purim to come that some of the joy rubs off on Ta'anit Esther also. I would like to begin with a presentation, we'll say, of an idea related to Ta'anit Esther and a few other things as well, as I shared just a short while ago with the Torah Tidbits folders, who are doing their job even though they are not able to munch on their snacks, drink their coffee, or have their lunch.
I want
want to start with a mushel. Young boy, let's say 8 years old, has recently received a gift that he's wanted, and probably this is not for today's children, I don't think, although they could certainly get this kind of gift. It was the kind of thing that we wanted when we were 8 years old, and that is the super-duper deluxe box of Crayola crayons. The one with 128 colors, the one with a built-in crayon sharpener, and all we had was, you know, the little box of 8 or 12 or 24, and we were drooling over that that big box. And you got it. Okay, so this is a story of a boy who had his big box of 128 color crayons. Of course, side point, there are several colors that Crayola has retired because they are not politically correct. One of them is Indian red. You will not find Indian red anymore. You'll find the color, but you won't find that name because it's like a racist kind of comment. You won't find Prussian blue. They retired that. And my favorite example is flesh. They don't do flesh anymore because there are too many different colors of flesh. So they renamed all their colors. Anyway, the story is of an 8-year-old boy whose parents went out for a brief period of time and left him alone since he was mature and could be trusted by himself. And when they came back, they found that he busied himself during their absence with his crayons coloring beautiful pictures all over the walls of the kitchen. And, of course, they got upset, and, of course, they yelled at him, and, of course, he had to scrub the walls to get the crayon markings off. Now came the time for punishment. The yelling and the screaming is one thing, and the scrubbing the walls is one thing, but he has to be punished. And it was, young man, give me those crayons. You will not see these for 1 month. And the kid cries or whatever, that's his punishment. Then the father comes and he says, sit down here. He puts clean paper in front of the kid, hands him his box of crayons during his 1 month ban on their use. And he says, for the next hour, you will do nothing but draw pictures with these crayons, which we will then take to the local hospital's children's ward and give them to the children to post on their walls to brighten their day. Perhaps this kid is a little confused now. You took away my crayons, and now you're giving me those crayons, which I can't keep for the month, in order to draw pictures. And that's a punishment also. So which is the punishment? Is it confiscating the crayons, or is it using the crayons for this noble task of making pictures for the kids in the hospital ward? The answer is both. And you see this with Purim in the following way. When commentaries throughout the ages have grappled with the question of what the Jews did in the time of Mordechai and Esther to deserve being threatened with total extinction at the hands of Haman. True, we look at it with hindsight and we say, V'nahafochu, there was a tremendous turnover in the month, and what looked like gloom turned out to be joyous for the Jews in La Yehudim, Hayata, Ura, V'simcha, V'sason, V'kor. That's all good and well, but we were threatened with extinction, and this threat loomed over the heads of the Jews for almost a year. Haman was arrogant enough and confident enough to announce his intentions, and maybe he did it on purpose, almost a full year before he was to carry out his threat. Usually, when an enemy is plotting your downfall, the element of surprise, last-minute surprise, no time to prepare, is the way to go. Haman had all the confidence that let the Jews squirm all of this time, and he went in the month of Nisan and announced that Adar Tukam, or whatever they called the months in those times, in the future, the Jews would be extinguished. But he didn't realize that Mordechai and Esther were strategically placed in order to do something about it. And when Esther said to Mordechai, gather the Jews in Shushan and fast for me because I'm going to the king and I haven't been called for 30 days and it could be a fatal move, that was Pesach. That was in the middle of Nisan. Haman was hanged shortly thereafter. I'm skipping part of the story that everybody knows. And after Haman was out of the picture, the Queen Esther comes to Ahasuerus and she says, there is one other thing I would like. Rescind the edict against the Jews. I mean, nice of you to get angry and nice of you to kill Haman, but that's not going to save us. King says, well, you know, I can do everything, but I can't do that because a decree can't be rescinded. And by the way, this is very symbolic and very Musar-filled because let's say there is a king in this world whose edicts cannot be rescinded, which is baloney anyway. But even if it were to be so, there is one king, the king that counts, whose edicts can always be rescinded, and that's God. In fact, that's the story of Purim. In fact, that's the story of Judaism in general, and it's the story of Jewish history, of decrees against individuals and against the people that are rescinded by virtue of, often, teshuvah, repentance, mitzvot. So it's almost the absurdity of, yes, my beloved queen, I will do anything you ask. Ask for anything up to half the kingdom. She asked for her life. And she said, who is this evil person who threatens to do this? All right, off with his head. All right, not off with his head, but, you know, hang him. And they did. And the king goes out. And what does the Megillah say? The anger that he felt was calm. So he's fine, but the Jews are still in trouble. And he's not going to rescind it. The best he could do is offer them to write their own decree, which he will sign and seal, and see if they could counter it. But there was almost one full year of extreme nervousness. Question that is asked is, what did the Jewish people do to deserve that kind of threat? Obviously, they didn't deserve being extinguished, Baruch Hashem, but they did deserve that punishment of having this threat over them for so long. Part of the answer is, well, I should tell you, you know, more of the answer than I'm going to address. Part of the answer is they were in exile and they were liking it too much. They had left Bavel a mere 70 years earlier with crying and the noble statement of, who can forget Jerusalem? If I forget Jerusalem, may my right arm lose its cunning or wither. And Eich Nashir et Shir Hashem, how can we sing the joyous songs on alien soil by the waters of Babylon? And we will cry and all of these things, very nice. And here they are, celebrating with Ahasuerus, who was mocking Judaism and God, flaunting the plunder of the Beit HaMikdash, parading around in the garments of the Kohen Gadol, as our tradition tells us. And they're at this party, this long party of eating and drinking, where everyone gets the food and the drink that they want. So the threat came. All right, that's the same in my analogy as yelling at the kid and making him scrub the walls. But where's the punishment? Or where is, more than the punishment, the atonement, and more than atonement, what's called tikkun. Tikkun is repair. Well, the repair for inappropriate eating and drinking comes in two forms. One form is you shall abstain from eating and drinking on a day which we will call, let's call it Ta'anit Esther, the day before we celebrate Purim, as a reminder that eating and drinking is what got us into trouble in the first place. Then, on Purim Day itself, we eat and drink almost to excess. Se'udat Purim is a mitzvah. Mishloach Manot of gifts of food is a mitzvah. Even though Matanot Levionim, most people give with money, the mitzvah there is also to give food to poor people. In fact, when someone is asking what's a respectable amount to give to tzedakah, the answer usually is the amount equal to feeding poor people, you know, a meal. So you figure out what that costs. So then the simple person will say, well, I'm a little confused here. First you tell me not to eat and drink as an atonement for excessive eating and drinking. Now you're telling me to eat and drink in excess as an atonement. Which is it? The answer is it's both. Just like the child lost his crayons for his own personal use and was given those crayons for the noble use of drawing those pictures for the children in the hospital, so too do we abstain from eating and drinking on Ta'anit Esther and drink l'shem mitzvah for the sake of the mitzvah as also part of the process of atonement and repair, tikkun. There are two other examples that I think fit very nicely into this model, and they are gold and cows. Gold reminds us of the sin of the golden calf. Gold was removed by the Kohen Gadol from his own raiment, whatever that means, I just like to use the word once in a while, from his garments. He removed the golden garments when he went into the Holy of Holies, the Kodshei Kodashim, on Yom Kippur. He had only four pure white linen garments. The garments that had gold in it, either actual gold or gold threads, were taken off. The special linen garments were put in. And the reason that's given is Ein Kategor Na'aseh Sanegor, the damning evidence against the Jewish people, namely the gold, because of Egel HaZahav, is not able to be the defending model or the defense attorney, that's the Sanegor, so to speak, for the Jewish people. So at that sensitive moment that the Kohen Gadol goes into Kodesh Kodashim on Yom Kippur, where he is representing us in our plea for atonement, you don't go in with gold. Yet, guess what he brought in with him? A gold fire pan with coals, with incense. Guess what he saw when he walked into Kodesh Kodashim? A gold-plated aron with a gold lid, with kruvim of gold, with poles of gold, and rings of gold, and they say that in the Beit HaMikdash, the first one, the walls were plated with gold. Solid gold all over the place, and he removes his gold garments. Well, it shouldn't confuse us anymore because of what I've just been telling, both with the eating and drinking as well as with the analogy with the crayons, which to me is more significant. But no. Because when God says, take off those gold garments, that's what you have to do. When he says, use gold in the Mishkan as an atonement, then that's what you have to do. Imagine the absurdity of a Kohen or the Jewish people saying, we won't make the Kruvim out of gold, we'll use silver instead, because gold is a reminder of Chet HaEgel. We won't make the menorah in the Beit HaMikdash out of gold, because it's a reminder of Chet HaEgel. Absurd. Why is it absurd? Simply because the Torah commands you to make the menorah out of gold and to plate the Aron with gold and to make the Kruvim with gold. So you can't decide, no, that would not be appropriate. That's exactly appropriate because that's exactly what the Torah commands. The best you could do, the best we could do, is understand it in the context of Chet HaEgel. Chet HaEgel was a sin with gold. Part of the process of atonement and tikkun is all of the gold that was used in the Mishkan. But we also have to understand, not because we made up that rule, we have to understand the rule is given to us that the Kohen Gadol removes his gold garments, because that also fits the model. Similarly, the cow. The Mishnah says all shofars are kosher for Rosh Hashanah, except for the horn of a cow. Why? Explain the commentaries. Because ein kategor nases sanegor. It is not the appropriate thing to bring the horn, to use the horn of a cow to blow shofar on Judgment Day, when that's a reminder of Chet HaEgel. Better to use the horn of a ram, which is a reminder of the dedication of Avram Avinu with Akedat Yitzchak. That's a good thing. But it's only that way because that's what we're commanded. We are commanded to take a shofar and forbidden to use the horn of a cow, so we don't. Now that we have that prohibition, let's understand it in context of Chet HaEgel, the Egel being the son of the cow. On the other hand, you've got Para Aduma, which the commentaries say is exactly meant to be an atonement for Chet HaEgel, and that's why it's reddish, as in red gold, and that's why it's a female cow, which is the mother of the calf. So what happens to your ein kategor nases sanegor? Maybe we would think logically that the animal whose ashes we must use in atonement could be anything else but a cow. No. Sometimes it's this way, sometimes it's that way, and it's most effective because it's both ways. And I see it in the cow, I see it in the gold, I see it in eating and drinking Tanit Esther Purim, and I see it in crayons. And you could see it in anything else you want to see it in. But to me, all of those things fit very nicely together.
You are listening to Torah Tidbits Audio, the pre-Purim show on Ta'anit Esther. Listen now to a track from A Taste of Yom Tov, the Purim album, a medley of songs. Strangely enough, it begins with a Hanukkah tune, but that stanza of Ma'os Tzur, which relates to Purim. Maybe afterwards we'll make a comment about that. In the meantime, enjoy.
No.
I think what it boils down to is that Chanukah is a celebration of a Jewish victory over a certain kind of anti-Semitism in the world. That's putting it lightly and generally and superficially, but Purim is also a victory over anti-Semitism, and therefore the two are related. Parshat Zohar is a reminder of the challenge and the plight of anti-Semitism vis-a-vis the Jew, and a reminder, a sobering reminder, that this is a perennial battle. We say it in the Pesach Seder, Bechol Dor Vador Omdim Aleinu L'Chaloteinu, in every generation someone stands up against us. They have all different kind of names and all different kind of forms. The bottom line in the Haggadah is, V'HaKadosh Baruch Hu Matzilenu Miyadam, God saves us from their hand. That's a message of Chanukah, that's certainly a message of Purim, and that's the reminder of Parshat Zohar, all rolled into one. Let me see if I could put Parshat Zohar in a nutshell. The Torah commands us to remember what Amalek did to the people of Israel as they came out of Egypt. Unprovoked attack, no strategic reason for doing it except here's this nation and we don't like them and we don't want them. And what happened was we succeeded in the battle to weaken the Amalek attack. We did not vanquish them. We were commanded as a result to destroy Amalek, and we have not succeeded, and we have sort of evidence from the Torah that this will be an ongoing battle through the generations. So one wonders what would have happened had we succeeded completely. For example, as the Haftorah for Parshat Zohar records, that King Shaul HaMelech Saul was commanded to do battle against Amalek, and he kept the king alive, and that from there was able to perpetuate the nation. But if it's described by God as a perennial battle, what exactly does that mean vis-a-vis the actual wiping out of Amalek? And I think perhaps it is sort of a proof, or at least a demonstration, that we're not talking about a specific nation only. We are talking about Amalek. Amalek, remember, was the grandson of Esav, and there's a medrash that says that Esav told his grandson Amalek, I was not able to get back at my brother Yaakov. I leave it to you to continue the job and maybe to do it. And Amalek had taken on that task throughout generations in many guises. And when we say that Haman was a descendant of Amalek, we mean that literally. When we say that Hitler was a descendant of Amalek, I don't know how accurate that would be to mean it literally, but certainly it is accurate to mean it as far as a spiritual heir of Amalek. If we look to Haman, for example, in the Megillah, as having desired, having felt slighted by one Jew, and then be able to say, it is despicable to me to strike out just at Mordechai, because they told me that Mordechai was a Jew. Rather, Haman desired to destroy every man, woman, and child, the nation of Mordechai. That already tells you who we're dealing with and what kind of person that we're dealing with and what kind of enemy we're dealing with. This is the meaning not only of Zachor Eit Asher Asolecha Amalek, remember what Amalek did, but it's more maybe to the Lo Tishkach, thou shalt never forget, thou shalt not forget, because it comes to add something. You know, the classic definition that because Lo Tishkach, thou shalt not forget, is something in your heart without having to verbalize it, therefore Zachor, to remember, has to be something more, and it's defined as the reading of the Torah portion of Amalek this particular Shabbat right before Purim, as maftir, etc., etc. But it's also more than that. It's different from that. If zachor means remember what Amalek did, then lo tishkach means never forget that we're dealing not just with Amalek, but with an Amalek type. And unfortunately, the world is filled, and history has been filled with Amalek types. So whereas we celebrate the vanquishing of Haman and the squashing of his plot, it's still only a partial kind of victory. It's an ongoing battle, and the battle continues. And yet, on the other side of the coin, we do continue to celebrate Purim, even though we still have Haman types in this world. That's an important lesson also. In fact, if you think about it, Hanukkah, Purim, even Pesach, is the celebration of a redemption that is not the final complete redemption. We still can't say, and the Jews lived happily ever after, but we still celebrate. Pesach is still Pesach, and Purim, and Hanukkah, and other dates, I would even add in our own time, a day like Yom HaAtzma'ut, Israel Independence Day, is not celebrating the final realization of the dream and everything is hunky-dory. It's far from it. But it is certainly a milestone from a perspective of a religious Zionist to be able to celebrate, to say Hallel on Yom HaAtzma'ut, and to sum it up in the official greeting of Yom HaAtzma'ut, and that is Moadim L'Simcha, happy festival, but L'Geula Shlema, not but, and L'Geula Shlema. That's the message, but it's a message of Purim and Hanukkah long before it was a message of Yom HaAtzma'ut. Among all the Purim songs and music that I've ever seen, the following track struck me as odd because it relates to Parshat Zohar. The song is called Machot Timcha, which comes from the command to destroy and wipe out the remnant of Amalek and the memory of Amalek. And I just never thought of it in terms of a song. But for whatever it's worth, here it is.
Amalek.
By the way, that was from Avrami Flam's album, which we played last week as well, Greatest Purim Hits by Noam Productions. Let's talk a little bit about Parshat HaShavua. It sort of gets eclipsed. Strange that I use that word. There is a total lunar eclipse scheduled for this Motzai Shabbat. In Israel, it will begin around 11:30 p.m. and last for a little over 3.5 hours. There's a whole thing I wrote in Torah Tidbits about Kiddush Levana around the time of lunar eclipse. But let's leave that for now. As I was saying, the Parshat HaShavua tends to get eclipsed when there is something like Purim in the air. And I'd like to take a quick look at Parshat Tetzaveh and maybe even make some kind of comment about a connection, or more than that, a contrast, or even more honestly, having Tetzaveh as the background for Purim is kind of significant. First, one might suggest in general that any of the parshiot that deal with the building of the Mishkan, the Beit HaMikdash, realize that in contrast, we have the announcement in the Megillah of who Mordechai was. He was one of the people exiled after the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, and with the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, and there's a certain irony in there. There's an irony that the story of Purim takes place specifically in exile, and that's like a condition of the existence of the story of Purim. And the aftermath of the Jews receiving permission to rebuild the Beit HaMikdash, and of course, without going into too much detail, the fact that many did not respond to the call, and relatively few did. Specifically with Tetzaveh, though, and it's not always Tetzaveh that's right near Purim, but it is this year, and it's a common match-up, so let's focus in on that. You have the command in Tetzaveh to make the garments for the Kohen Gadol and for the Kohanim in general, and that automatically pops into mind the well-known tradition that we have that Ahasuerus paraded around with the plunder from the Beit HaMikdash, from the temple, specifically clothing himself in the garments of the Kohen Gadol. That's the traditional explanation to a big chet, which is numerically eight garments of the Kohen Gadol, in Chur Karpas Utchelet. And you have the description of dressing up Mordechai, dressing Esther, dressing up in order to present herself to Ahasuerus. Haman's suggestion to Ahasuerus that a person who found favor in the king's eyes should be dressed up in royal garb, thinking of himself when he was then told by Ahasuerus to do what he said exactly to Mordechai, and then Mordechai, in the earlier stage, after the decree was announced, put on sackcloth and ashes, couldn't be part of the king's court, shabbily dressed like that. And then, when he dresses up, the Megillah describes it. So you have dressing up as a very important statement in Megillah, and it is a very important statement from the Parsha as well. Without belaboring this point, although I think there's something significant there, I just want to add one other idea, and that struck me when I was looking at the Haftorah. The Haftorah describes the command to Shaul to gather an army and fight against Amalek. Shaul fails in carrying out God's complete instructions, leaving the sheep alive, as well as Agag, the king of Amalek. And in a very symbolic scene, we will say, from the book of Shmuel, where Shmuel has told Shaul that he didn't listen to God properly, and Shaul says, "Oh, I'm really sorry, but come back with me, and we'll bow to God together, or do it while I bow to God, come with me." Shmuel refuses to go with him. There's a pasuk whose pronouns are a little confusing here, and sure enough, you have different opinions as to what exactly happened. But the wording is Vayomer Elav Shmuel. No, before that, Vayomer Shmuel El Shaul. Shmuel, the prophet, says to Saul the king, Lo Ashuv Imach, I will not go back with you because you have disregarded and despised God's words, and God is fed up with you as king. Vayisov Shmuel Lalechet, Shmuel turned to go, Vayichazek Bechnaf Me'ilo, and he, who's the he? Don't know yet, and he grabbed the corner of the Me'il, the garment, Vayikara, and it tore. Rashi says the pshat, the plain understanding is that Shaul grabbed onto Shmuel's coat, so that he shouldn't leave, and it tore. Some say that Shmuel grabbed onto Shaul in some way and tore the garment as a symbol, which he describes in two psukim later, where Shmuel says, this is a sign that God has torn the kingdom from you this day. And there is actually a commentary that says that Shmuel tore Kriya because of the experience. But one way or the other, you have in the Parsha the Me'il of the Kohen Gadol and a prohibition that you're not allowed to tear it. You have to reinforce it, the hem and the collar, in such a way that it shall never be torn. So you have that ironic contrast between the Parsha and the Haftorah, which is not the Haftorah of Tetzaveh, but as I said, it most often is, because Zohar, more than any other Sedra, coincides with Tetzaveh. So you have to find all of these kind of things, but the broader picture is just take a look at the emphasis on clothing and the tradition that we have of dressing up on Purim, especially in disguise and in costume, but dressing up in general. So we'll leave it at that, and that's all the time we have for this issue of Torah Tidbits Audio. I do have enough time to wish you well, a Shabbat Shalom and a Purim Sameach, regardless of which day you celebrate Purim. There are two of them coming up, most of the world, Motzoi Shabbat and Sunday. We in Jerusalem, Sunday night and Monday. Other cities do it both days. Some cities do it both days because of a question mark as to whether they were truly walled cities or near enough to a walled city from the time of Yehoshua. But that's a detail which we'll have to leave for some other time, or for the extension of this show for the second edition, we'll call it. In the meantime, Lehishtamea. Okay, I'll explain it again. 23 minutes and 23 minutes is what I submit to Israel National Radio, parentheses, Arut Sheva, for their, quote, live stream broadcast. They build those two 23-minute halves into a full hour with news and news update and commercials and announcements. And that's the show that first airs at 5 p.m. Israel time on Arut Sheva's website. It's repeated again during the night, early the next morning, parts of Friday. I don't know exactly the schedule. I don't know if they know the schedule. But that's the show that gets into the live stream. In addition, there's an archived version, which used to be those two 23-minute halves put together into a 46-minute show, and that was on the audio on demand, or on demand audio, of Arut Sheva. Now, because I've been making the show longer, usually, for OU Radio, Arut Sheva says, we'll take it also. Especially since I use their uploading facilities in order to get the show to the OU the way they want it. So what you're listening to now could not have been heard on the live stream, can only be heard on OU Radio, or, if they put it up, on Arut Sheva's on-demand audio in the English department. Got it? That's the story. So if you have the patience to listen past my saying Lehishtameah, which is usually the last word, you will hear these words, and you will next hear a song. But the introduction to the song is as follows. Approximately 21 years ago, a little girl was born, and with her birth at the old Miskav Ladach Hospital in Jerusalem, not, of course, the old one, but the newer old one, or the older new one, with that birth, my wife and I had our third daughter, our first and only Israeli-born child, and our daughters Miri and Aviva had a cute little sister. 21 years later, this little girl has grown into a fine young woman who is, Emir Tzashem, B'sha'a Tova, to be married the week before Pesach, and is just in the process of celebrating her 21st birthday. In my family, we have this tradition of not celebrating a specific single day, but we celebrate however many days or few days there are from a person's Hebrew birthday to English or vice versa, whichever comes first and second. And we're right in the middle of that period now. In the weeks before her birth, when we already knew that she was to be a girl and we had already decided on her name, I played a game to my unsuspecting other daughters. By every Motzoi Shabbat, when I said Havdalah, I quoted Megillat Esther, as we do, we all do, with the words, La Yehudim Hayata Ora V'Simcha V'Sason V'Kar. But because her name was to be Ora, I would say, La Yehudim Hayata Ora V'Simcha V'Sason V'Kar. And that was like a private joke between my wife and me. And only after the birth and after the naming did we clue in the unsuspecting sisters that we had been telling them each week that they would be having a sister, which they never knew. I mean, they knew they would have a sibling, but not which it would be, and that her name would be Ora. So that's the story, and I dedicate this song to Ora Ziva, for a happy birthday and for a happy life as she now embarks on the newest and most dramatic change of life, from being a single free spirit to being hopefully a happily and healthily married woman. difference, of course, between the verse as it appears in Megillat Esther and the sentence which we say in Havdalah is the addition of Kain Tihyalanu, which we don't read in Megillah, may it be for us also, which is a very nice sentiment and prayer. After mentioning that the Jews in Shushan and in Ahasuerus' kingdom were privileged to Ora, Simcha, Visason, and Yakar, each of which symbolized different aspects of Judaism. Ora symbolizes Torah, and not just because they rhyme, because Torah is the light of the Jewish people, really the light of the world. And we say in Havdalah, so may it be for us as well. Let me conclude this edition of Torah Tidbits Audio with a comment about the 2 days of Purim. Everyone knows, almost everyone, many people, some people, know that in Megillat Esther, we find the explanation as to why there is a celebration of Purim on the 14th of Adar, and another celebration on the 15th, basically geared to the Jews of Shushan, extended and defined by the sages as walled cities whose wall dates back to the time of the conquest of Yehoshua. A lot to be said on that, and I don't want to say a lot now, but I do want to go back a step in this and say there is nothing that requires, per se, 2 different days of celebration just based on the story. In other words, had the sages decided that they were to be a 1 day holiday called Purim, and that it would take place on the 14th of Adar, or the 15th of Adar, or any other date for that matter, we would celebrate that day as Purim. We would be commemorating what happened in Megillat Esther, etc., etc., without the unusual measure of basically splitting the celebration depending on location, to put it like that. Had they decided to make a 7-day holiday or an 8-day holiday or a 12-day holiday or a 3-day holiday, they could have done that also. We would not be surprised, because we wouldn't know otherwise, that they declared a 3-day holiday of Purim to correspond to the 3 days fasting that Esther asked of the Jews of Shushan to fast on her behalf. Or any other things. I don't know, 127 days of Purim to commemorate the 127 provinces of Ahasuerus. I exaggerate that, and that's tongue-in-cheek. But there is nothing that says, therefore, Purim has to be the 14th of Adar, unless it's a walled city, in which case it's the 15th of Adar. That's the way it is. But it didn't have to be. The fact that it is allows us to exercise hindsight, already knowing that it is, and see some kind of special symbolism or some message, better than symbolism, a message in the fact that there are these 2 days. Furthermore, if you look through halachic works today, you will find an impressive list of cities around Israel, and even some reputed around the world, that there was a question mark as to whether they should observe the 15th of Adar or the 14th as their Purim. Some places read Megillah both days, twice each, because of Safek, but really only one, the 14th in those places, is the real one and gets the brachot. The other one is done as a Safek thing. There's only one place that has definitely not Purim on the 14th of Adar, and definitely yes Purim on the 15th of Adar. And I am privileged to be speaking to you from that place. That place is called Yerushalayim. The only other city mentioned in Megillat Esther besides Shushan or Shushan Habira, and it's mentioned in the context of that's where Mordechai was exiled from. And yet, Yerushalayim is part of Purim celebration more than logic would indicate that it should be, because of this idea of the two different days, and by the fact that Jews don't live in Shushan, even if we knew exactly where it was, but the Jewish community of Yerushalayim has a tradition for centuries of observing Purim on the 15th of Adar. What it does is point to Jerusalem, underline, bold, emphasize Jerusalem in its role in the Purim story by virtue of its absence. Because Im Eshkachech Yerushalayim, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, that was the clarion call of the exiles who went to the waters of the rivers of Babylon, and there they sang a sad song. How can we possibly sing joyous songs on alien soil? Al Admat Nechar. And yet in a very short period of time, the Jews in Ahasuerus' kingdom, and especially in Shushan, were celebrating, eating, and drinking like everybody else. As if to tap them on the shoulder and say, hey, why did you forget Jerusalem so quickly? Where is your sadness? Where is your longing? Where is your low spirit because you don't have Yerushalayim? And that comes to the fore because of the existence of what's called Shushan Purim, which would be more correctly referred to, as far as we're concerned, as Jerusalem Purim, Yerushalayim Purim, which is what it's called sometimes. But it accentuates not just from those of us who live in Yerushalayim, and not those of us who spend Purim Day in Yerushalayim, but Jews all over the world who are aware of the fact that Shushan was different, but much more importantly, that now and for always and forever, Jerusalem is different. And this is one of the ways it comes across. On that note, and it's a great note, I believe, I wish you once again a Shabbat Shalom, a Purim Sameach, whichever day you celebrate it on, and Lehishtamea.
Es gerechli Yimesh kochech Yerushalayim Tishkach yemini Tidbak l'shoni Lechi yikini Im lo Es gerechli
Beginning of the baseball season than the fun of Purim, but it's tied to both. Don't ask me how. I finish with the following famous piece.
On the St. Louis team, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know's on third.
That's what I want to find out. I want you to tell me the names of the fellas on the St. Louis team.
I'm telling you, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know's on third.
You know the fellas' names?
Yes.
Well, then who's playing first?
Yes.
I mean the fellas' name on first base.
Who?
The fella playing first base for St. Louis.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
Well, what are you asking me for?
I'm not asking you. I'm telling you who is on first.
I'm asking you who's on first.
That's the man's name.
That's whose name?
Yes.
Well, go ahead and tell me.
Who?
The guy on first.
Who?
The first baseman.
Who is on first?
Have you got a first baseman on first?
Certainly.
Then who's playing first?
Absolutely.
When you pay off the first baseman every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it. Why not? The man's entitled to it.
Who is?
Yes.
So who gets it?
Why shouldn't he? Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes. After all, the man earns it.
Who does?
Absolutely.
Well, all I'm trying to find out is what's the guy's name on first base?
Oh, no, no. What is on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
That's what I'm trying to find out.
Well, don't change the players.
I'm not changing nobody.
Take it easy.
What's the guy's name on first base?
What's the guy's name on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on third. We're not talking about him.
How did I get on third base?
You mentioned his name.
If I mention a third baseman's name, who did I say is playing third?
No, who's playing first?
Stay off of first, will you?
Well, what do you want me to do?
Now, what's the guy's name on third base?
Well, what's on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on third.
There I go, back on third again.
Well, I can't change their names.
Will you please stay on third base, Mr. Broadhurst?
Please, now what is it you want to know?
What is the fella's name on third base?
What is the fella's name on second base?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
I don't know.
Third base.
You got an outfield?
Oh, sure.
St. Louis has got a good outfield?
Absolutely.
The left fielder's name?
Why?
I don't know. I just thought I'd ask you.
Well, I just thought I'd tell you.
Then tell me who's playing left field.
Who is playing first?
Stay out of the infield.
Don't mention any names out here.
I want to know what's the fella's name in left field.
What is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who is on first?
I don't know. Third base.
Oh, take it easy. Take it easy, man.
And the left fielder's name?
Why?
Because.
Oh, he's center field. Will you pick up your hat, please? Pick up your hat and stop this
Now, look,
Mr. Broadhurst.
Yes.
Wait a minute. You got a pitcher on a team?
Wouldn't this be a fine team without a pitcher?
I don't know. Tell me the pitcher's name.
Tomorrow.
You don't want to tell me today?
I'm telling you, man.
Then go ahead.
Tomorrow.
What time?
What time what?
What time tomorrow you're going to tell me who's pitching?
Now, listen. Who is not pitching? Who is on?
I'll break you all around. You say who's on first?
Why come up here and ask?
I want to know what's the pitcher's name.
What's on second?
I don't know.
Third base.
You got a catcher?
Yes.
The catcher's name?
Today.
Today. And tomorrow's pitching?
Now you've got it.
That's all. St. Louis has got a couple of days on a team.
Well, I can't help that. All right. What do you want me to do?
Got a catcher?
Yes.
I'm a good catcher, too, you know.
I know that.
I would like to play for the St. Louis team.
Well, I might arrange that. I
would like to catch. Now, I'm being a good catcher. Tomorrow's pitching on the team, and I'm catching.
Yes.
Tomorrow throws the ball, and the guy up bunts the ball.
Yes.
Now, when he bunts the ball, me being a good catcher, I'm going to throw the guy out at first base, so I pick up the ball and throw it to who?
Now, that's the first thing you've said right.
I don't even know what I'm talking about.
Well, that's all you have to do.
Is to throw it to first base.
Yes.
Now, who's got it?
Naturally.
Who has it?
Naturally.
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 Okay.
Now, you've got it.
I pick up the ball and I throw it to naturally.
No, you don't. You throw the ball to first base.
Then who gets it?
Naturally.
Okay.
All right.
I throw a ball to naturally.
You don't. You throw it to who?
Naturally.
Well, that's it. Say it that way.
That's what I said.
You did not.
I said I throw the ball to naturally.
You don't. You throw it to who?
Naturally.
Yes.
So I throw the ball to first base and naturally get it.
No, you throw the ball to first base.
Then who gets it?
Naturally.
That's what I'm saying.
You're not saying that.
Excuse me, folks.
All right, I'm sorry, friend.
I throw the ball to naturally.
You throw it to who?
Naturally.
Naturally. Well, say it that way.
That's what I'm saying.
Don't get excited. Now, don't get excited.
I throw the ball to first base.
Then who gets it?
He better get it.
All right, now don't get excited. Take it easy.
Now, I throw the ball to first base. Whoever it is drops the ball so the guy runs a second.
Mm-hmm.
Who picks up the ball and throws it to what? What throws it to, I don't know. I don't know, throws it back to tomorrow. A triple play.
Yeah, it could be.
Another guy gets up and it's a long fly ball to because. Why? I don't know. He's on third and I don't care.
What was that?
I said, I don't care.
Oh, that's our shortstop.
Now, you might be wondering what that had to do with Purim, even though you do know what it had to do with the opening of baseball season, which actually isn't happening until Pesach, but you got spring training that's coming in right with Purim. But it does have a connection to Purim itself, probably many, many connections, but I won't bore you with all of the details. Let's leave it now, as in the famous expression related to Purim, v'nahafoch hu. As in, v'nahafoch, who is on first?